Did you know nearly one-third of supplement consumers in the U.S. are unsatisfied with the current immune-supporting drinks on the market? Help your consumers get the products they want with Immuse, the novel, clinically researched postbiotic that activates our body's natural defenses at the cellular level for year-round immune support. Formulate with the immune health ingredients backed by 30-plus research studies. Learn more at immusehealth.com. That's Immuse, I-M-M-U-S-E, health.com.
Hey folks, thanks for tuning in to Taste Radio, the number one podcast for the food and beverage industry. I'm Ray Lateef, the editor and producer of Taste Radio, and you're listening to episode 221, which highlights interviews with a few of the leaders, innovators, and entrepreneurs who joined us on the podcast during the first half of 2020, including Siete Family Foods co-founder and CEO Miguel Garza, Nick and Elise Oleksak, the co-founders of Bantam Bagels, Miyoko's founder and CEO Miyoko Shinner, Ben Van Leeuwen, the co-founder and CEO of Van Leeuwen's Ice Cream, Orgain founder and CEO Andrew Abraham, and Gail Becker, the founder and CEO of Cauli Power. Just a reminder, if you like what you hear on Taste Radio, please share the podcast with friends and colleagues. And of course, we'd love it if you could review us on the Apple Podcasts app or your listening platform of choice. Let's kick off the show with Miguel Garza, who we featured in episode 214. Miguel is the co-founder and CEO of fast-growing Mexican-American brand Siete Family Foods, which markets tortillas, taco seasonings, queso dips, and enchilada sauces, all of which are plant-based and grain-free. In the following clip, Miguel spoke about the importance of family in how the company operates, the hallmarks of its product development and innovation strategies, and why Siete avoids chasing trends. Everyone in your family works for the company. A lot of folks can't work with members of their family, usually out of fear that money will muddle the waters. And you know what? Sometimes it does. How do you make it work?
I don't know if we necessarily have a playbook, but I can tell a story about how we grew up. So we grew up in a household where, as a family, we were all very close. And my mom had this thing that she would do where if we ever fought, right, and we're not like any, like we're not unlike other siblings, like we would fight as kids. And if we ever fought, my mom would occasionally make us like do one of two things. Either like we had to sit on a couch and hug each other until like we stopped fighting, or, you know, you would put on like the big, like a very large shirt, and you would have to like hug it out with your sibling in that shirt. And I remember a few times where the power, and I think that's why there's, you know, just in the time that we're in, why it's so difficult, there is a power that comes with hugs and love that kind of overcomes. So you mentioned family first, family second, business third. Do everything with love is our seventh core value. And I think that that's how we're able to do it. If you're rooted in love and in this idea that the family does come first, then there's an underlying trust that gets you through working together on a day-to-day basis, where we all understand that we're trying to grow a Mexican-American food brand for this generation of consumer. And because we all know we're striving towards that goal, we can trust that even in our disagreements, that we're actually all doing it for the family, for the team, and not for ourselves. So to tie it back to that hugging story, like I think there was just this, you're in a fight and then 15 minutes later, after a 15 minute hug, and you're like, oh, this is my family, this is my blood, and that's more important than anything. It's more important than ego. It's more important than aspirations. And so I think that that in itself laid a foundation for how we would love each other, even through the difficult times of running a business. And I say that we don't have a playbook because we're still growing. And I think that we still have many challenges to come. But I do know that if we continue to stay focused like we have on family first, family second, business third, and doing everything with love, that we'll have a good shot at it.
Your mom sounds like a genius. One of the most striking things about Siete and its growth is the amount of innovation that you guys have pumped out over the years. The company markets no less than 5 product lines and also has seasonal products. Can you talk about the hallmarks of your product development and innovation strategies?
Yeah, heritage inspired and fundamentally innovative. And I think that's the cornerstone. So if we're going to make a product, it has to be heritage inspired. And then on the flip side, it has to be fundamentally innovative. And I think that my sister could probably speak to this much better than I could. She leads our innovation, but it's often rooted in solving problems, with the idea being that that's what we're supposed to do as a business. We're supposed to solve problems for the consumer. And so the initial product was solving a problem for herself, in that she wanted to continue enjoying in the foods that were culturally relevant to her, in this case, tortillas, and that she couldn't anymore on the diet that she was on, this being like a grain-free paleo type diet. So then she made an almond flour tortilla, and it needs to be heritage inspired in that, like, we're not trying to make things that aren't culturally relevant for us and authentic to us. So we're not making traditional Mexican products as much as we're making authentic Mexican-American products, where we feel like we are well positioned because we are Mexican-American. We do our best to not chase trends, and that's mainly because we're focused on solving problems, and we feel that chasing the trends would be inauthentic and that it's often hard to forecast and predict anyway. So for us, it's how can we be focused on creating something that's an authentic expression of ourselves but solves a problem? And the thesis is that if we solve a problem, that we're not the only ones with that problem in the marketplace, and that hopefully it solves problems for others as well. That's not to say that we don't look at data and that we don't understand the marketplace, because we definitely do. But I think that we're not, in our innovation, we're not driven by the external macro trends, because we're trying to build something that is and that feels authentic to who we are as Siete.
Next up are Nick and Elise Oleksek, the co-founders of bagel and breakfast bite company Bantam Bagels. Launched as a retail concept in 2013, Bantam Bagels has since evolved into a sprawling platform brand that includes mini stuffed pancakes and egg bites that are sold at Safeway, Target, and Costco, and also in pastry cases at Starbucks nationwide. In this clip from episode 208, the Oleksek's explained why investing in PR has been crucial to the brand's success, and how they define the phrase, fake it till you make it. Oftentimes, PR is overlooked, especially with early stage brands, early stage entrepreneurs. It's expensive. Why did you feel the need? I mean, what compelled you to invest in PR early on?
Honestly, I think we felt like there was so much to this idea that we wanted to do it right from the beginning. And, you know, you asked the question of like, kind of, how did we know what the next step for the business would be and where should we go next? And I think the fact that we had Erica, who's our publicist, you know, she's been our publicist from day one, the fact that we had her bringing the brand out into the marketplace in a unique and different way, to Elise's point, allowed us to make those decisions in a much more strategic, analytical way than if we didn't have someone who was sharing the brand with the media, getting the brand out there, you know, allowing our story to grow in both like the conventional media channels, but also in like a very holistic way, like through blogs and Instagram and influencer posts. Like, having that public relations side to growing a business, we knew we had to do it. We knew from the very beginning we had to have an outlet to share what we were doing, because what we were doing was so different and unique. Like, no one had done this before with such an iconic food. We knew that we needed the support to get it out beyond New York City. And I think that is when we realized we needed to get the product beyond New York City. You know, we were getting all of this national media exposure and this buzz around the brand and the product. And there was just such a demand to get it outside of that little retail shop in the West Village and to go, you know, explore the wholesale route. You know, our first major wholesale customer was QVC. And we baked all the bagels for QVC out of that small little bakery. It was insane. We were running 24-hour baking shifts. Like it was madness. But we got that opportunity because we had got placement in Specialty Food Magazine. And that's where the QVC buyer saw it. And that's how she called our phone to ask us if we could get her 30,000 bagels 2 weeks after that. That was driven so much by, you know, our focus on PR and our focus on spreading the brand, spreading awareness of what the product does and what we were trying to do. So I think as you look at entrepreneurs, maybe PR isn't on the top five list of things to include when you start, but from our perspective, it had to be. And I think it changed the way that the brand grew and it allowed us to be in a lot more places a lot faster than if we didn't have it.
Getting into places a lot faster helps when you are running 24-hour shifts and baking bagels all the time.
Yeah. Well, you got to get the sale and the demand before you can create the supply when you're on a budget. Yeah. So you got to elicit that demand, and marketing is not to be overlooked. Everybody thinks if I build it, they will come. But the truth is when you build it, they often don't come unless you tell them to come.
There's another, we'll call it an adage, that I've seen associated with Bantam, which is fake it till you make it. And that's, you know, prevalent in the food and beverage industry, that notion of we've got to make it look like we're making it until we actually do. But I think it's a misunderstood phrase sometimes. I mean, what does it mean to you guys?
I think it means present the product and the brand in a way that people will say yes to you. Present yourself in a way where you show up like you are backed by this 24-hour, 7-day-a-week production facility, that you are, you know, you are the brand that they can rely on to stock their shelves, to, you know, be the product that can meet the partnership, like with a retailer. You know, like when we did our first retailer sell-in, it was out in, you know, the West Coast in like 2016, I think. And we, again, had never done retail before. We didn't really understand the landscape, but we went in with confidence. We went in that we could be the product that, you know, they needed, and it worked, and we sold in. And I think it was just like that first taste of just having this confidence in how the product can be successful and kind of sharing that with the people that you're pitching, or, you know, the potential partnerships that you may be going into business with, I think is kind of how we look at, I guess, the fake it till you make it adage, is, you know, really doing everything you can to present yourself that you can handle anything, and then figuring out how to actually handle it if the opportunity comes through.
While we may have presented, yes, we got this, and then behind the scenes been learning as we take that next step and been growing along with our growth, at the same time, we've never let a customer down. We've never, literally in 3 years, 8,000 stores plus, 500 million bagels shorted an order, missed production, you know, fallen short on anything that we've promised. So I do think, like, maybe the fake it till you make it wouldn't be well received if you don't deliver on what you're promising.
Yeah.
We never promise something that we don't literally fall on our sword to make happen.
Mike, I heard you're starting a beverage company.
Ray, let's say I was. Do you have any suggestions for a complete partner?
Absolutely. Ingredion. Ingredion is a leading global plant-based ingredient solutions provider to the food and beverage industry with a diverse portfolio, including sweeteners and sugar reduction technologies, plant-based proteins, starches, and hydrocolloids.
Of course. Ingredion's 360 value framework delivers value according to your brand's specific needs through consumer well-being, environmental impact, and value creation. Ingredient's market research and insights for innovation can help uncover opportunities within the beverage space. For instance, figuring out what added health benefits consumers need. They have a network of technical experts that will help you solve your pain points to get you to market faster. With Ingredient, you gain a partner who helps you deliver the total beverage experience that keeps consumers coming back.
To learn more about Ingredient, head to tasteradio.com/beverage.
The New Beverage Showdown returns to BevNet Live in New York City on June 12th and 13th. pitch your beverage startup in front of a panel of expert judges, our live audience, and viewers tuning into the live stream. To learn more, visit bevnetlive.com.
Let's continue with Miyoko Shinner, the founder and CEO of pioneering plant-based cheese and butter company, Miyoko's Creamery. In a clip from our wide-ranging interview, which we featured in episode 198, she spoke about how poor leadership led to past failures and early struggles with Miyoko's, and why she describes her business as, quote, a mission with a company. What did you learn from the experiences that you had before starting Miyoko's that you've been able to incorporate into your current business?
Well, just about everything. But I think the most important thing is my lack of leadership. I really didn't know how to be a good leader. And if you can't lead your team and inspire them, if you can't create a culture that people want to embrace, then doesn't matter how good your product is, what your sales channels are, you're just not going to succeed as a company.
How did you learn to become a good leader? What were some of those
characteristics?
Well,
don't presume that I am a good leader yet. I'm on my way. I'm getting better.
Well, what were some of the characteristics? What do you think are the characteristics of a good leader? And what were you lacking in your past company?
Sure. I think I was a poor communicator. I hadn't managed to, even though I was very, very good at selling the product or the mission outside of the company, I hadn't really taken the time to communicate that internally and to inspire the team within. So that was one thing I had to learn. I also had to learn patience. I had to learn how to monitor myself and sort of, you know, when there's always going to be some sort of confrontation at work, issues that arise with personnel. And I am learning, let me correct myself because I'm not 100% there yet, to remove myself from myself. And you know, it's that question, what would Jesus say? It's like, what would a good CEO say? How would a good leader think? And to become more intentional in everything I do and think about the strategy of how to nurture that culture where people want to give to the company and they embrace it with passion and feel alignment with the mission, and they too want to make a change and they feel empowered that they are effecting that change.
It sounds like humility is an important characteristic of a leader as well. Humbling oneself is not something that I'm good at.
It's a challenge for all of us.
Yeah. Admitting what you don't know and admitting that someone might be better at a particular task than you are is really tough, especially if you're an entrepreneur. And I'm not an entrepreneur. I assume that it is one of those things where I'm not going to release the reins because I think I can do this better than you can.
Right. I was certainly like that in my last businesses. And that doesn't go very far. I mean, you have to learn to delegate. You have to learn to empower people. But then you also have to hold them accountable. And you do have to have some sort of barometer. And you have to hold them accountable, but do it in a way that doesn't make them feel like, you know, they screwed up or something. I mean, sometimes you do have to become the heavy. I mean, that I'm not saying that, you know, it's all just holding hands and kumbaya. That's not how it is. Because at the end of the day, the business has to be successful. We have this joke. It's not really a joke, but we're really a mission with a company. But we never forget that mission. And, you know, the first few years, I think I was so afraid of speaking about our mission that I didn't the first couple of years to the world. And yeah, I spoke about it to vegan communities, to our vegan consumers, but I never mentioned it to, you know, if I was at an industry conference or something like that, I would just say, oh, we're making a plant-based cheese. And I would just sort of tiptoe around the subject. And I finally realized at some point you have to stand for what you believe in. You have to be true to your nature, to your soul, to the world, and you have to become transparent. And I found it was actually at some sort of New Hope event where I was giving a talk. I was on a panel, and just out of the blue, I started talking about Angel, who is one of our cows. I have a farmed animal sanctuary. It's a 501c3 nonprofit. And I started talking about Angel and how she was a dairy cow that got out of the dairy industry. And you know, now she gets to chomp on grass and live her life according to the way she wants. And I wasn't sure how. I thought, oh my God, I put my foot in my mouth. I can't believe I started talking about her. And people came up to me afterwards and they were like, oh my God, I never thought about it that way. Thank you so much for sharing your story about Angel. I think I'm going to go vegan.
Wow.
And so I realize that if you talk about it in the right way, it doesn't matter what setting you're in. You can share your mission and not be afraid to turn people off. And that's my goal, is just to, wherever I am, I'm going to continue talking about it. I sneak something about animals into every talk I give. And, you know, I don't devote the entire talk to them. But just in a way to just sort of plant that seed to get people to start thinking, connecting about their food. And, you know, maybe the fact that that bacon came from, could have come from Goober. Goober is this really cute pig we have.
It sounds like a really cute pig.
He is really. All you have to do is rub his belly. He's about 500 pounds, but if you rub his belly, he flops over and then just breaks into this huge smile.
Nice. I've spoken with a lot of entrepreneurs, including some of the ones here at the Fancy Food Show, and they are mission-based companies. Where they get tripped up sometimes is not understanding that even if you are a mission-based company, as you mentioned, business is business, and you've got to achieve results. You've got.
Otherwise, you can't promote your mission.
Right. So how do you marry the two in a way that puts a level of importance, the same level of importance on each?
Well, I am a businesswoman, and so that is important to me, that we're making the right choices in business. You know, of course, the mission part is part of the marketing messaging to the external public, of course. And so, you know, we have to do it in a way that's balanced with all the things that, you know, the data shows you that people care about, which are obviously flavor. I mean, it doesn't matter how, if you're saving the world with a product, if it doesn't taste good, no one's going to buy it. And that's the bottom line. I mean, food has to taste good. And that's actually one of our values. You know, I was a chef. I've cooked in restaurants and I've written 5 cookbooks. I'm writing a 6th book right now. And food is our cultural heritage. It's really what distinguishes man from other animals. It's how we created culture. Man came around a table and broke bread together. You know, somebody in the old days when we discovered fire, someone would forage, somebody would hunt, somebody would fish, somebody would dig roots, and they'd come together and make a big pot of soup. And we found that humans were stronger together over food. And so food, there's such a strong cultural heritage to food. It has to not just nourish our bodies, but it has to nourish our souls. It has to taste good. I'm a foodie through and through. I love nothing more than cooking a big dinner for friends and gathering around the table and having wine and conversation. And so, yes, taste is number one. That has got to be king. But we have to balance it all. We have to balance taste with nutrition, with clean ingredients, and with mission.
Next, we have Ben Van Leeuwen, the co-founder and CEO of Van Leeuwen Ice Cream. Launched in 2008, the premium ice cream brand and retailer has evolved into a broad platform with 22 ice cream shops in New York and California and a wholesale pint business with more than 1,500 accounts across the U.S. In an interview included in episode 203, Ben discussed launching a business in the midst of a recession and why running lean was just the default when building the company. You mentioned that you launched in June of 2008. If I recall, that's when the recession was really coming into being, really coming into focus. People were starting to get really worried. Not the best time to open a business. How do you make it those first 2 years?
Well, I mean, we didn't know any other climate because we hadn't run the business in any climate other than that. And so, you know, we were lucky. We did well. But I think part of that, too, is that launching an ice cream business during a recession works because it's an affordable luxury. I think then we were charging like $3.50 for a cone. So that's something that, especially if you're feeling really bad, you might even be more inclined to buy.
$3.50 a cone.
Yeah, that was early on. That was
time
the price.
To change, yes. Yeah. It felt like there was some growing interest in sort of handcrafted artisanal products at the time, even 10 years ago, 12 years ago. Did you see other brands popping up that you could take influence from? Were there other ice cream brands like yours?
There actually weren't. One of the reasons we wanted to do Van Leeuwen is because there was nothing else in America like it. So there was no one else making ice cream using the best ingredients and using a really great base formula. So meaning lots of cream, lots of organic egg yolks, no stabilizers. So some people were doing some of those things, you know, a few good ingredients here, sometimes a good recipe here, but no one was doing everything. So we were inspired more by sort of ingredient producers and farmers and chocolate makers than we were other ice cream makers. we did have some really good ice cream in Italy that was made with pistachios from Sicily and, you know, chocolate from Domori, a really good chocolate maker. And that inspired us a little bit. But it was the ingredients that inspired us, because the experiences that, like, still move me a lot and, you know, move me even more than when I didn't have the stress of running a business on my shoulders, were sort of tasting something that was incredible, you know, that was made with a ton of care and not necessarily something fancy, but, you know, sourdough bread that was fermented with a ton of care and time, and chocolate that was made with beans from farms that were carefully cultivated and responsibly managed. And there was a lot of attention on the fermentation of the beans and the roasting. So to us, it was really exciting learning about those processes that make great ingredients great, and then tasting those ingredients and saying, wow, that really is something. So early on, one of the biggest tests we did when we were doing the product development for Van Leeuwen was chocolate. We love chocolate. And there were a decent amount of choices for chocolates for us to use. We didn't want soy lecithin. We wanted it to be completely traceable. We ended up going with Michel Cazelle chocolate, but they had like 7 different single origin or single farm chocolates. And we tested, I think, 35 different batches of chocolate and tasted all of them. But before we tested them, we were talking to experts in ice cream production. And the advice from them was, you don't need to use really good chocolate in ice cream. It's a waste. You're using cream and eggs, and those are going to completely cover up the chocolate. So don't do it. So we did not heed their advice, and we said, let's try it. We're just making samples at home. And we tasted it, and we were like, oh my gosh, this is the best chocolate ice cream we've ever had. So a lot of these norms in manufacturing that you would normally apply to a consumer packaged good, we sort of veered away from and said, no, let's try using the best chocolate. Let's try bringing the butter fat up to 19% and the egg yolks up to 8% and see what happens. Because these were things that, and still nobody in ice cream does these things. Nobody on the scale that we're doing it. Restaurants do, but no manufacturers do.
The Series A, what went into that decision? How did you assess your financial needs at the time?
We decided to raise capital because we felt like we were in a place where we had learned enough about running a business and learned enough about sort of our business and how we can optimize it. And we finally felt comfortable taking money because the growth path and the path to creating a lot more value in the business was clearer than it ever had been to us. Additionally, running a business, starting with $60,000 and going 10 years on that, is incredibly stressful. So to us, the dilution was kind of worth the peace of mind and a slightly less stressful existence.
It sounds like you've been running pretty lean over the years. Was that just intentional, or, and I ask this because I read about an investor when you announced the Series A, one of your investors said, described you guys as incredibly profitable. And this is a well-known investor, at least in the food and beverage industry. And when he says something like that, I mean, that says something. Was lean about turning a profit, or was lean just the way you knew how to run the business?
To us, running lean was just the default. You know, we were under the impression then that to grow a business, you wanted to try to spend as little as possible and make as much as possible.
I think that's the basic economics of running a business.
A lot of businesses aren't run like that anymore. So we, you know, it was very old, it shouldn't be old fashioned, but I think it's coming back into fashion. But that's just how we could survive, by doing it that way. And, you know, we were very, very thoughtful about everything. Oftentimes, I think, oversimplifying things, but saying, okay, if we hire this person, like, will they pay for themselves? And someone, a hire that might take 4 years to pay for themselves, like, we couldn't afford to do that hire then. A piece of equipment that would take, you know, 6 years to pay for itself, we couldn't do then. So we were just really, by default, we ran the business in a super lean way.
Mike, I was just in the kitchen and I saw this really cool THC-infused beverage brand called Eighth Wonder.
Ah, chill brand. They make cannabis bevs as well as beer and spirits. The product you're talking about is a super tasty cherry limeade cannabis seltzer called Lil Bit. And did you know Eighth Wonder was acquired last year by Houston's BioCity Hemp?
Yes, I did. That deal created a world-class, vertically integrated cannabis and craft beverage company. Bio's science-based processes for extracting THC from hemp have made the company the gold standard for cannabis products across Texas and beyond.
Bayou's cannabis portfolio includes Eighth Wonder as well as Howdy and Beach Break, all of which are distributed throughout Texas and Louisiana.
You can learn more about all these brands at eighthwonder.com, siphowdy.com, and sipbeachbreak.com.
On June 12th and 13th in New York City, hear from Icelandic Glacial, Lemon Perfect, GoPuff, Sachet, Diageo Ventures, and Lowe's Foods during the leading event for the beverage industry. Save on BevNet Live tickets through April 26th. Just visit bevnetlive.com.
Let's continue with Andrew Abraham, the founder and CEO of protein-centric brand Orgain. Introduced as a first-to-market brand of organic protein beverages, Orgain has since grown into a thriving platform for protein drinks, powders, and bars. In this clip, pulled from episode 197, Andrew discussed learning the ropes of the food and beverage industry, why entrepreneurs that are not well capitalized from the outset might be in for a bumpy ride, how he convinced his family that despite significant losses, the brand was on a positive trajectory, and why he believes that the best defense is a super aggressive offense.
How did you learn about the business? Because, you know, you bootstrapped, you're a doctor, you know, maybe getting on shelf at Whole Foods, you get on there once, but if nobody's buying it,
yeah, you're in trouble.
I mean, you've got a lot to learn and quickly. What was that process? Was it reading 120 books on business?
No, I mean, it's learning the hard way, right? I mean, I think one of my favorite quotes that I've heard is that being an entrepreneur is jumping off a cliff and building a plane on the way down.
Oh, nice. Right? I like that.
And that's exactly what it was. So yeah. I jumped off not knowing it was a cliff and then quickly realizing it was. And, you know, you just kind of have to figure things out and you make a lot of mistakes. I made a tremendous amount of mistakes.
What were some of the mistakes that you made that you felt like maybe with the right training you could have avoided?
Well, you know, there was things that never crossed my mind. Like you should really do a shelf study on a protein beverage that has 20 plus ingredients. I didn't do that. Our shelf study happened on shelf. So we made the product and put it on shelf. And I learned very early on that protein can geo and can, you know, it turns into pudding.
Your formulators didn't tell you that?
You know, they told me, but I think we just didn't take the proper steps to make sure that we were going to do a 12, 18-month shelf life study. It was first to market. We wanted to be aggressive. And we learned the hard way that, you know, you should do your due diligence, be careful. And we learned early on that that was a key mistake.
Otherwise, your customers are going to be drinking sludge?
And drinking pudding, yeah.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. I mean, I got a call that the drinks were not pouring out. And I never imagined that I would see that day, but I went to the store and bought a couple shakes and I opened them and
cut the Tetra Pak in half and eat it with a spoon.
Yeah. So that was the thing. Do you attach a spoon? What do you do? And obviously we had to do a withdrawal and figure it out. So there's a lot of mistakes that you learn, but because of those mistakes being so extreme and could have put me completely out of business, you learn. And today, you know, the due diligence we do is completely different.
Who was your first hire? Who was the first person to kind of help you along this journey?
You know, it's interesting. I was the sole employee for about 5 years and built the business to, a decent size. It was someone that was doing demos. It was a guy that was doing demos. His name was Todd. I saw him at Whole Foods and asked him to join us. And he started doing demos for us full time and helping me with events and so forth. And then from there, the first, you know, more senior hire was a vice president of sales. So that was our first hire.
How do you run a company for 5 years by yourself, especially when you are onto something? I mean, you must have known that this notion of a clean, organic protein shake, you were on the right track. I mean, why'd you wait 5 years, I guess?
It's a great question. And I think it's not because it was heroic on my side. It was more being naive. I didn't know any better. I thought, geez, I have to hire someone. It's a six-figure hire. There's a bonus involved. There's all these things I just can't afford to. So I just kind of put my head down and just did it myself. Everything from customer service to ordering ingredients to logistics, all of it. But, you know, looking back, I could tell you that that wasn't smart. It's smart when you're early on to get help, get people that are smarter than you, surround yourself with people that are smarter than you. And, you know, looking back, I think, you know, while it worked for me, I think a vast majority of the time, that's not a good path to take. It's good to get people in early that can help you. I think it's important to realize that whatever dollar amount you have in your head that you think it's going to take to launch a company, you should multiply that.
By
3 to 5, I think, honestly. Really? It really takes a lot more money, time, resources. You know, it takes a lot more bandwidth, everything. So I think as long as an entrepreneur goes into this venture knowing that it's going to be expensive and only get more expensive, I think you'll be okay. If you go in saying, I have $20,000 and I'm just going to have it cash flow, I think you're in for a bumpy ride.
How do you eventually convince your wife that this was going to work? Families are extremely important in this business.
Yeah.
I mean, if your family's not on board, I mean, that makes things doubly difficult, right?
It's very difficult. I mean, and I started Orgaine when Kathy, my wife, was pregnant with our first child. So it's very, very difficult. And then we had our son, our second son, 15 months later.
Wow. It's pretty quick.
It was quick. It was quick and very difficult. And it was during that time when I had started Orgaine. And at certain times, it didn't make sense, not only to her, but to me. You know, there's some dark times there where you kind of lock yourself in a room and ask yourself, is this really going to work? But, you know, I was seeing the letters come in from our consumers. I was seeing the feedback that we were getting. And I knew that if we could just weather the storm long enough, that Orgaine would succeed. I believed it a bit more than my wife. So I had to convince her. But I think eventually she understood and was willing to take the risk with me. And I think that's really important. I mean, it's you're going kind of on this journey, and it's important to have the support of someone that believes in what you're doing, not necessarily to the same degree, but is willing to support you.
So, I mean, what was your approach?
So my approach is, and continues to be today, to run as quickly as possible every day, to constantly innovate, to always be aggressive. I think the best defense is having a super aggressive offense, always. At the same time, while you're being relentless in making sure that you're growing and doing everything that you can to build the business, you want to make sure that you also have that infrastructure that you mentioned and make sure that, okay, it's wonderful that you have this growth, but is your quality there? Is your operations team built for this? Can you support it financially? So it's really twofold. One is keeping your foot on the gas, and the other is trying to make sure that everything on the car is in place, right? Because a lot of times, and to your point, there are a lot of companies that grow and quickly realize that they're missing a wheel along the way.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a combination of both, but certainly the mentality has always been grow aggressively and do whatever you can to further the business, but be strategic and smart. One thing I'll point out is to always be cautiously optimistic, meaning I've been in the business now 11, 12 years, and I've always maintained an attitude of making sure that you remain down to earth and that no matter how quickly you're growing, you can realize things can absolutely go wrong. And I think if you maintain that healthy fear, it helps tremendously.
Last but certainly not least, we have Gail Becker, the founder and CEO of CauliPower, the vegetable-forward brand best known for its gluten-free cauliflower crust pizzas. After just 3 years on the market, the company generated an estimated $100 million last year. As part of an interview featured in episode 196, Gail discussed the value of taking risks, breaking traditional rules for packaging and retailing of a food brand, what she learned about the food business from working at her father's store as a 5-year-old.
I think one of the biggest mistakes that a lot of entrepreneurs make is that they're afraid to admit what they don't know. And when you do that, you lose out on so much. I'm a big believer in hiring people smarter than I am, experts in their field, and listening and learning to what they have to say. There are some things I brought to the table. Obviously, I worked in marketing and I ran a lot of businesses, so I knew that end of it. But I didn't know anything about food. And so I think it's really important to admit what you don't know and hire around it. And I'm a big believer in saying that I learn every day because I do. I'm a big believer in saying as great as CauliPower is, it's never easy. And I sort of hate when I look at Instagram and everything looks so wonderful and so easy. And as all your listeners and anyone in the food industry knows, it's hard every day. It is hard every single day. Worth it, but really hard.
Now, you did bring a lot, you're right, to the business. You had a background in marketing and PR. How do you think that benefited you starting out?
I think there were two things that actually really helped. So one, I had worked in marketing for many years. And working at an agency was really interesting because it was my job to counsel other companies. And there were so many occasions when you'd go into a company and you'd say, well, we think you should do this, or you think I should do this. And half the time they'd listen to you and half the time they wouldn't. Well, the great thing about Colleague Power is I get to take my own advice. It's not always the right advice, of course, but I do get to listen to my own advice, and it's worked out well, and we get to take risks. And I think that's one of the greatest things about being a young company that's growing quickly is you do get to take risks, and you should take risks, and they're not always going to work out, but it's really what defines this industry. I mean, this industry has evolved because big food hasn't brought what people were asking for. So it's really up to this industry to listen to people and take the necessary risks in order to bring those things to market.
Breaking rules is kind of your MO. What are some of the rules you've broken along the way?
Well, I don't know how much time you have allotted in this podcast, but so some of the rules I broke. One is, I think I broke a rule on the packaging. I would say, you know, I think we broke a lot of rules with our packaging. You know, don't put big black letters on the front, you know, keep it clean. And I think that going into Walmart very early for us was something that I was really counseled against, but decided to do. Moving out of pizza, I think, was something that a lot of people said, you shouldn't do that. You know, just make pizza 16 different ways and don't do anything else. I didn't listen to that. By the way, I did listen to a lot of advice. I listened to more advice that I didn't listen to. But there were some things that I just followed my gut. I'm not a young entrepreneur. And I think one of the things about starting a business later in life is that you have a bit more confidence to, you know, follow your instinct and do something differently. And for me, if I was going to give up what I had in corporate America, and I had a very nice existence there, but if I was going to give all that up, it was going to be for something pretty meaningful. And in order to be something meaningful, you have to do what your heart tells you to do. And that's all I've ever done in building Colleague Power. So in a world that is divided by so many things today, and in a food universe where there are so many foods that are don't eat this or don't eat this, or this is free of X, Y, and Z, how about if we just put the food on the table and all eat it and not feel separated, but feel united? I love that about food. It's funny. Sometimes people ask if I'm a foodie. And you know what? I'm not really a foodie, but I love meals. I love cooking. I love feeding people. My parents were both children of war. They had no food. And even when I was growing up, and even when times were tough, the one thing they would never skimp on was food. Because that is how you showed someone you love them, is you cooked for them. And of course, you saved all the leftovers and put them in the freezer because you would never want to throw those away. So I think I was destined to
You're
be in the
frozen
food.
Throwing that away?
Exactly.
It's just a tiny cup. Oh, that's lunch tomorrow.
I wish my mother could have known that I entered the frozen food business. She'd be very proud. But that's what it's about. It's about how food can bring people together. And that is what I love about this industry. And that is what I love about the people in this industry. And that is why I love being a part of this and helping people in some tiny, tiny little way.
That brings us to the end of episode 221. Thank you so much for listening, and thanks to our guests, Miguel Garza, Nick and Elise Oleksek, Yoko Shinner, Ben Van Leeuwen, Andrew Abraham, and Gail Becker. As always, for questions, comments, ideas for future podcasts, please send us an email to ask@tasteradio.com. On behalf of the entire Taste Radio team, thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.